We start with a prayer. Father, we thank you for George. Thank you for his ability to present truth with wisdom. And we pray for him today that this speech also today is going to be carrying your wisdom, Father, from heaven in a way that people understand. Amen. Denne talen legges ut på nett, så når talen ferdig og du har lyst til å dele den med, if people like to share this speech with others, you can just download it from internet just after the speech. But the floor is yours. I think we all love you. That will, you will...
Okay.
Yeah.
Good morning. God jul. Godt nyttår. Jeg gleder meg å være her. Yeah? Okay, I'll stop now. But I want to say that it is such an honor and a privilege to be here with you today and see so many people, so many friends who came here to be with me, and I came here to be with you. This is one of my last days in Norway, and I was telling my very good friend Trygve and Barbro that I've been to Stavanger more than I have been to any other city in Norway. But this time I'm staying in the best hotel that I've been before. I'm staying at their house, so thank you for hosting me. And it's been such a great honor to have people like Trygve, Barbro, and other friends, Sigve and Live here, that we work so closely together, and we've become such close friends. And their support and your support for the state of Israel and for the message of hope and freedom that it carries is so important to us. So truly, thank you very much. And I want to start today by telling you a little story that happened for me here in Stavanger. It was about a year ago, November 2013. And I was in Stavanger for a business conference that the embassy organized together with the a Chamber of Commerce and some other partners here in Norway to bring Israeli and Norwegian businesses to work together. And after a long day of speeches and meetings and conferences, I went back to my hotel room at the Radisson. And I went there to relax. It was a very long day, so I went to bed. I didn't even remove my suit yet. I was so tired. And I opened on the TV. And I wanted just to watch something and to unwind, to relax. And I ended up looking for something in English. I ended up watching the Discovery Channel. You know the Discovery Channel, I suppose. And there was a program in the Discovery Channel about the temples of Ramses II, who was the Pharaoh of Egypt more than 3,000 years ago. Magnificent buildings and temples, monuments, amazing, from stone. And these buildings have lasted until today for 3,300 years. And for 10 minutes, for about 10 minutes, I was completely carried away by the enthusiasm of the narrator of the program. Until I remembered that Ramses II was actually the Pharaoh of the Exodus. It was during his time that Moses led the people of Israel out of Egypt. And suddenly, I had a thought. What if I could travel back in time and actually visit Ramses II? And I started imagining the following conversation. I would go to him and I would tell him, "Oh, mighty Ramses, I'm a visitor from more than 300 years in the future." And I can see him looking back at me and saying, "Who's this crazy guy? Explain yourself." So I say, "Well, Ramses, I come here from the future, and I have good news for you, and I have bad news." Yeah. "What's the good news?" "The good news is, believe it or not, there is a nation that is alive and well today, that will be alive and well 33 centuries from now. So what's the bad news? The bad news is that it's not gonna be you. Who then, he would ask. At this stage, I imagine myself taking him to the front of the temple, to the terrace, and I would point out to those buildings and to the slaves building those buildings, and I would tell him, you see those slaves, those Israelites, those Hebrews, they are the ones who are going to be alive and well 33 centuries from now. Now, that must sound like the craziest thing anyone could say. The Egypt of Ramses was by far the longest empire that has lived and the mightiest empire of the ancient world, who's already at that time existed for more than 1,500 years. And you, have you been to Egypt? Have you seen the pyramids of Giza? These pyramids, for 4,000 years, were the tallest man-made structure in the world until the construction of the Eiffel Tower in 1889. And what were the Jews? They were slaves. And you tell Ramses that this mighty Egyptian civilization will collapse and the Jews will live? How did that happen? I believe the answer is this. Ancient Egyptians and ancient Israelites asked the same question. How, in our short life on this planet, can we be part of something eternal? The Egyptians answered as follows. How do you become immortal? By building monuments of stone so great that they will outlast the winds and sand of time. And it's true, the buildings survived, but the civilization that built them died. The Jewish answer was different. How do you become immortal? It was not by building monuments of stone, but by looking forward, by living and practicing your values and teaching them to your children and they to theirs, and so on until the end of time. In other words, hope. Jews kept hope alive, and hope kept the Jewish people alive. Yeah. And it is the same hope that kept them alive even through the toughest days in the last 3,000 years of history. In all of human history, there have been less than 10 exiles of an entire people out of their land. And it's highly unusual to take a whole nation and just throw it out. But no nation has ever experienced a double exile, being thrown off their land twice. No nation except the Jewish people. The Jewish people were first exiled from Israel by the Babylonians. They survived, returned to Israel, and later built the Second Temple. But then in 70 AD, the Romans destroyed the Second Temple, forcing the Jews into exile once again. And ever since then, Jews have lived in almost every corner of the earth. And despite the passage of time, despite the distance from their land and from each other, and despite persecution and pogroms and inquisitions, they managed to keep their unique identity, to keep the yearning to go back someday to their home. However, this in the terrible summer of 1938, the longing for a home has been transformed from a yearning into a moral necessity. In July 1938, the leaders of 32 nations gathered in the French spa town of Evian. They gathered there knowing that something terrible was going to happen to the Jews, knowing that unless they did something, a tragedy would unfold that would exceed all the 20 centuries of antisemitism put together. And one by one, without exception, the nations of the world closed their doors. At that moment, the Jewish people knew that on the vast surface of this planet, there is not one square inch they could call a home, a place where when you have to go there, they have to let you in. Today, thanks to the state of Israel, the Jewish people have a home. How did it happen that the state of Israel was established immediately after the Holocaust, the greatest crime of all? The answer lies, I believe, in the story of my music teacher, Avraham Nov. When I was 7 years old, I joined the marching band of the Arab Christian community in Jaffa. You were told by Trigve before that I'm also a Christian. By the way, I'm out of the 1,000 and something diplomats that Israel has, I'm the only Christian diplomat of Israel in the world. So it's an honor for me to be here. And we have our community center in Jaffa that Paul might know how it works in our community there. And I joined the marching band of my community that we, every Easter and every Christmas, we have a marching band that goes out in the streets and makes a carnival for the holidays. And when I'm going home soon, I'm going to play with them again this Christmas. And when I was there, I joined the marching band when I was 7 years old. That's when I started. And this is when I met Avraham Nov, who was my music teacher. And he taught me to play the flute, and later he taught me to play the clarinet as well. But Avraham was not just a normal person. He's a Holocaust survivor. And his entire family, everyone except him, was murdered by the Nazis. He was the only one that was able to survive because a Nazi officer found him very gifted playing the violin. So he took him home during the war to entertain his guests. And he spent the war entertaining the guests of a Nazi officer in his home while his mother, father, brothers, sisters, cousins, everyone has been perished from the earth in terrible ways. And when the war was over and he was left all alone, he could have easily sat and wept and cried over the greatest crime of man against man in history and over the fact that he was left alone and no one left. But he didn't. He looked forward, not backwards. He chose life, not death. Hope rather than despair. Avraham came to Israel. He got married. He built a family and started teaching the same thing that saved his life, music. He became the music teacher of hundreds and thousands of children all over the country. And when he saw the tension between Arabs and Jews in Israel, this Holocaust survivor decided to teach hope through music to hundreds of Arab children like me. Holocaust survivors like Avraham are among the most extraordinary people you can find. And I was always curious to understand, how were they able to survive, knowing what they knew, seeing what they saw? But throughout the 15 years I've known Avraham, and I know him until today, we're still very good friends. He's still alive in Israel and still teaching music. And through the 15 years I was very close to him, he never spoke about his past, except once when I demanded to know the history. And what I came to realize, that was Avraham was not the only one, and that many Holocaust survivors did not speak about those years even to their families, sometimes for decades or even a lifetime. Only when they had secured a future did they allow themselves to look back in the past. Only when they had built a time of hope did they allow themselves to look back to the days of despair. Under the shadows of their greatest tragedy, they made it possible for hope to be reborn. The Jews came to their old new home, Israel, and became the only people in the world that live in the same land, practice the same religion, and speak the same language today as 3,000 years ago. Israel revived the Hebrew language, the Hebrew culture, and has contributed to our world in ways unthought of ever before. Israel is a symbol of hope to the world, for it has shown what a small nation can achieve under the most adverse conditions, turning every curse into a blessing. For 66 years, Israel has been developing agriculture to grow food where no food was ever grown before, developing medicine to heal sicknesses that were not healed before, and developing technologies to create possibilities, human possibilities that never existed before, bringing Microsoft chairman Bill Gates to say that it's no exaggeration, and I quote, to say that the kind of innovation going on in Israel is critical to the future of the world. Why did the Jewish people and the state of Israel became world leaders in medicine, agriculture, technology? Because they looked forward. And this choice to look forward, to keep hope, was the same choice that was taken by my grandparents that made it possible that I stand here today before you as an Israeli diplomat. I come from a Palestinian family. My family has lived in the city of Jaffa for long before the state of Israel ever was established. My family from my father's side, the Deek family, goes back in Jaffa for more than 400 years, as far as we know. And before the War of Israel's independence broke out in 1948, my grandfather George, after whom I am named, worked as an electrician at the what was called the Rutenberg Electricity Company under the British rule back then. And he was not very interested in politics. And since Jaffa was a mixed city where Jews and Arabs lived together, it's no surprise that my grandfather George had some Jewish friends. In fact, his friends at the electricity company even taught him Yiddish, the Jewish language then, making him one of the first Arabs to ever speak the language. And in 1947, he got engaged to Vera, my grandmother. And together, they had plans to build a family in the same place where the Deek family has lived for 400 years, Jaffa. But a few months later, those plans changed literally overnight. The British mandate was about to end. And since there were two peoples in the land, Jews and Arabs, the UN decided to divide the land to two, the partition plan, a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews accepted it, they said yes, the Arab world said no. And when the UN approved the establishment of Israel, and a few months later Israel declared independence, the Arab leaders refused to accept its existence, and they declared they warned the Arabs in the land that the Jews are planning to kill them if they stay home. They told everyone, leave your homes and run away. They said they will need just a few days. Hello. They said they will need just a few days in which with five armies, they promised to destroy the newly born Israel. And my family, horrified by what might happen, decided to flee with most others. So a priest was rushed to my family's house, and he wedded in the house my grandparents, George and Vera, in haste. The wedding was planned a day before. My grandmother did not even have time to get a dress. They were so afraid of what's going to happen. They just wanted to get married so they can be together and run away. And after their sudden wedding, the entire family started fleeing north from Jaffa towards Lebanon. And after a long journey, most of it by foot, my grandparents, George and Vera, reached Lebanon. And they stayed there for many months. And while there, my grandmother gave birth to my first uncle, Sammy. But when the war was over, my family was still on the other side of the border, and it seemed that the fate of the brothers and sisters of the Deek family was to be scattered around the globe. Today, because of that year, I have my relatives scattered in Canada, the US, the UK, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Australia, and many more places. But I'm in Jaffa. And my grandfather, he realized that they had been lied to, that the Arabs did not win the war against the Jews as they promised to do. But at the same time, the Jews did not kill all the Arabs as they were told that would happen. So my grandfather looked around him, and he saw around him nothing but a dead-end life as refugees. He looked at his young wife, Vera, who was not even 18 at the time, and his newborn son, Sammy, and knew that in a place stuck in the past with no ability to look forward, there is no future for his family. While his brothers and sisters saw their future in Lebanon, in Syria, in other Western or Arab countries, he thought otherwise. He wanted to go back to Jaffa, his home. Because he worked with Jews in the past, and he was a friend to some of them, he was not brainwashed with hate. My grandfather George did what very few others would have dared. He reached out to those that were considered his enemies, and he got hold of one of his friends from the electricity company and asked for his help to get back. And that friend, of whom I've only heard through my father's stories and never knew his name, was not only able and willing to help my grandfather come back, but in an extraordinary act of grace, he even got him his old job back at the electricity company, making him one of the very few Arabs that work in the Israeli electricity company. And the reason that I'm standing in front of you today as an Israeli diplomat and not as a Palestinian refugee from Lebanon is that my grandfather had the courage to take a decision that was unthinkable to others. Rather than falling into despair, he found hope where no one else dared looking for it. He chose to live among those that were considered his enemies and to make them his friends. And for that, I and my family owe him and my grandmother eternal gratitude. The decision of my grandfather was the same decision that made it possible for the Jewish people to be alive and dwell today, 33 centuries after the Exodus. Look forward, keep hope, and teach your values to your children, and they to theirs. Friends, many thought that the struggle of Israel would end when the state of Israel was established. Many believed that the dream has come true and that our hopes have been fulfilled, and now the Jews can finally live in peace and without fear. But the establishment of Israel resembled the opening of the Red Sea, and Israel is crossing the sea, still standing inside the sea, in between the water. And often it feels as if the sea is closing down on us. After the Holocaust, the nations of the world said, never again. But today, it looks as if anti-Semitism has returned to virtually every country in the Middle East, and unbelievably, even to Europe, from Greece in the south to Norway in the north. And at the heart of it is hostility to Israel. Of course, not every criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, but make no mistake what happened. In the Middle Ages, Jews were hated because of their religion. In the 19th and 20th century, they were hated because of their race. And today, when it's no longer done, no longer politically correct, to hate the people for their religion or for their race, today, they are hated for their state. The reasons change, but the hate stays the same. Anti-Zionism is the new anti-Semitism. And despite everything they have been through, it seems that even in their own home, in Israel, the Jews have to fight for the right to live in peace. It is hard not to wonder how history would have looked like had the Palestinians welcomed the Jews, saying, welcome back. This is your home. but it's also our home. So let's find a way that we can live together. Instead, the Arab leaders rejected the UN partition plan and launched a military campaign with one goal in mind: the complete annihilation of any Jewish existence in that part of the world. Since its inception, 66 years ago, Israel had to fight three existential wars, facing the horrific choice of to be or not to be. And the struggle continues to this day, when our neighbors launch rockets at Israeli cities and refuse to accept Israel's right to exist as a national homeland, when we face threats of nuclear annihilation from East and calls for boycott from the West. Friends, since its first day, the State of Israel has reached out its hand for peace. For many years, Israel's call for peace has been a lone voice in the wilderness. Ani leshalom v'chi adaber, hema lemilchama. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Psalm 120. Friends, Israel always has and always will face all challenges with the courage that you find only in those that whose ultimate aim is not victory, but peace, not triumph, but life, the ability to live without fear. But friends, make no mistake, it will not be an easy task, because Israel's adversaries resent Israel not for what it does, but for what it is. Israel is the place where democracy and liberalism remain unshakable, even amidst existential threats. Israel is the place where Christians like me can live openly as Christians without fear. Israel is where the press is free and the judiciary is independent, where a Palestinian can criticize the government openly on TV and go to sleep knowing that he will wake up a free man the next day, protected by the freedom of speech. Israel is where Jews and Muslims and Christians work together in its hospitals to treat all peoples of all faith alike, where Arabs and Filipino immigrants win popular reality shows, where universities teach students of every race, religion, and nationality. The British historian Paul Johnson wrote, "In the last half century, over 100 completely new independent states has come into existence. Israel is the only one whose creation can fairly be called a miracle." Friends, Israel's existence and achievements are living testimony to the greatest message of humankind: the defeat of tragedy by the power of hope. Today, just before I go back to my hometown Jaffa, I have come here to be with you and to celebrate the State of Israel. We celebrate the liberty, the diversity, the energy, and the creativity. And friends, today we celebrate our courage to look forward, our determination to believe, and above all, our decision never to give up on that thing that keeps our humanity alive, our hope. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to add something on a personal level. And I'm speaking now also as an Israeli diplomat, but I'm mostly speaking as George and as a Christian. Because I'm here, this is very special for me, because it's the first and only time, because I'm leaving soon, that I'm speaking in a church in Norway. And on a Sunday, at least. I spoke here before, but it wasn't a sermon. And I decided to add something on that note. You know, in 2 weeks, I'm going to be back home and celebrate Christmas with my family. One of my favorite things of being a a diplomat in Norway is because I'm Orthodox. Our Christmas is on 6th and 7th of January. We celebrate Christmas after you. So one of my favorite parts is the fact that I can celebrate Christmas twice. First time here and then back home. But I'm very happy that I'm going to be with my family for Christmas. But I keep in mind that we have friends here who grew up in the Arab world, that at the same time, while I'll be celebrating Christmas with my family, nobody is going to be celebrating Christmas in Mosul, in Iraq, because the last Christian was expelled from there less than a year ago. Nobody's going to be celebrating Christmas in Afghanistan, because the last church there was destroyed in 2010. Nobody's going to be celebrating Christmas in Saudi Arabia or the Gulf countries, because Christianity is prohibited by law in those countries. Nobody is going to be celebrating Christmas in Syria because there's nothing to celebrate in that country anymore. And this is the situation for all Christian communities today in the Middle East. The only place where Christians can live freely and safely and the only place where the number of Christians is actually growing in the Middle East is Israel. All over the region, the number of Christians have been going down. Jordan is the only country where the number of Christians have stayed the same because they have a lot of children and many of them immigrate. So one compensates for the other and their numbers stay around 200,000, more or less the same since 50 years ago. And in Israel, the number of Christians has increased by 500% from 30-something thousand in 48 to 158,000 today. But what I want to say is that the struggle of Israel, as I try to say it through my speech, and I hope I have some time for a few words, the struggle of Israel is a struggle of hope. But it's also a struggle, not just hope in very vague and general terms, but when I say hope, I mean it's our ability to accept each other and our difference, our ability to see that we are a majority of Muslims and we have Christians among us and we respect their way of living, they respect their faith. And what we are seeing today in the Middle East is an attack on our ability to be different. And the Jews were victims to the same hate that we are experiencing as Christians in the region. Because why were Jews hated throughout the ages, first as religion, then as race, and today as a state? Because they insisted on being different. They refused to assimilate in their communities. When Europe was Christian and very religious, Jews insisted on keeping their own faith. When it moved on, they refused to assimilate to the local culture or to the local traditions. They were very respectful to others, but they wanted to keep their own traditions, their own unique identity to themselves. And unfortunately, Europe failed in its ability to respect and to accept the difference of the Jewish people. And Israel is experiencing the same trouble today in the Middle East because, again, it is different. And the reason, I mean, if Israel was a Muslim country, the Middle East would have had no problem with it. It is because it is a Jewish state that it is not accepted. Because Israel insists on the right to be different, on the dignity of being different. And while most minorities, including the Christians in the Middle East, do not have the power to stand up and resist those challenging their difference, Israel is the only minority in the region that has the power, the courage, the strength, and the will to stand up and say, we want peace, we want to live as good neighbors with you, but we insist on staying as a Jewish state and a democratic state. We insist of being a liberal country where everyone can live in freedom, and we insist on our right to be different in this region. And we will do everything in our power, and we will fight to the last breath to protect our right to exist and to be different. And we live today in times that it has, you know, we in Europe or in the Western world, in the Christian world, we have moved very far from our core values. I mean, we have gone through 400 years of revolution in the since the 17th century. A lot of people are saying that what's happening today in the Middle East is the same thing that happened in Europe in the 17th century with the 30 Years' War, the big war, Catholics and Protestants that shaped Westphalia Agreement, that shaped Europe as we know it today. And I do believe that there is a lot of similarity. First of all, it was the same thing that made these two things happen then and today. What brought the big wars, the big revolution of the 17th century? It was a revolution of information technology. Gutenberg invented the typing machine. And that typing machine revolutionized the world, because what happened is that everyone could suddenly have a book, everyone could read for himself. And suddenly, in the beginning of the 17th century, you had in London alone 1 million copies of the Bible, all of them smuggled from Geneva because it was illegal to have a Bible in the UK. The only ones before that, if you wanted to know what is written in the Bible, in the book, what is right and what's wrong, you go to the priest, he would read it in Latin, and then he would give you the answer. Yeah. The priesthood had a monopoly over information. And what happened in the 17th century, in that time when the typing machine made the revolution, is that people started reading and understanding for themselves. Yeah. And that marked the beginning of the of Europe being disillusioned with religion, not with faith, not with God, but with organized bureaucratic religion. And that has brought the ability that people could read for themselves, brought up Protestantism, Lutheranism, and the new churches as we know them in today, and everyone could suddenly speak for himself. And then we had the big war between the old and the new, between those who wanted to keep a monopoly over culture and information, and those who wanted everyone to be able to read and do himself. And while it is weapons that won the war, it was ideas that won the peace afterwards. If it was the ideas of people like John Locke and Thomas Hobbes and Milton and Spinoza, all of them from the 17th century, they are the ones who put the idea of liberalism, of freedom, of equality of human being that set the world as we know it today. And those ideas brought a process that went on, or still going on, for 400-500 years, a process of secularization. In the 17th century, it was secularization of information. As we said before, only the priest had all the information. You had to go to them to ask them for answers. In the 17th century, information became secular. Everyone could have his own information. In the 18th century, it was secularization of power. It was this big separation of church and state with the French Revolution and the American Civil War and the democracy that they had in the US. It was the first time that power became secular. It's not in religious hands or in kings sent by God. In the 19th century, it was secularization of our culture. Rather than going to the church, people started going to museums and galleries. Hegel, the philosopher Hegel, once said that instead of morning worship, the modern man reads the newspaper. And in the 20th century, it was secularization of morality. Rather than basing our morals and our values on our Judeo-Christian values, the Christian values that we are based on, morality has become based on this concept of human rights and universalism, something completely detached from our core values, which this secularization has brought us with the scientific revolution that escorted it, brought us wonderful opportunities. Today we have technology that we can do whatever we want. We can take all the choices we want. If today you want to go to Israel, it takes you a few hours to take a plane and travel there. Imagine that 300 years ago. Unthinkable. Today, if you want to see what is happening in Brazil, you open your computer and you see exactly what is happening there. Today, if you want to get married, you can choose. I want to marry in the church, or I want to marry in the city hall, or maybe both. Today, the possibilities we have are endless. But the problem is that we moved from a world with, in the 17th century, we had a lot of meaning to our life. We had a sense of purpose to our life, but very little options, very little possibilities, very little choices. Today, we move to an opposite world where we have all the possibilities and all the options. Nothing is impossible in our world anymore. But we live in a world where our sense of purpose, our meaning, has almost vanished. Yeah. People don't know what is the reason to wake up in the morning. And this has caused the crisis, the moral crisis, that we see in our world today. And when I hear people saying that what is happening today in the Middle East is exactly what happened in Europe in the 17th century, yes, it's very similar, because the same thing that caused that revolution is causing today's revolution. A revolution of information technology. What the social media, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, what these social media are doing is exactly the same revolutionary effect that the printing machine had in the 17th century. We are seeing the next level of information technology. We have seen the same next level of how information is going to change our world. Because the world as we have known it through the last 500 years, it feels at least that it has come to exhaustion. And now we're entering a next stage. But the difference between what's happening today and what happened in the same 17th century is that why it's the same reason that is causing it, the idea behind it is completely opposite. While before we were living in a world that went to a process of secularization, while people were disillusioned with organized religion, today we are going through a process of desecularization. We are going to a process where people are disillusioned with the Western world that lost its sense of meaning. People who are here go to fight in Syria, and you ask yourself, what makes a person gives up life, welfare, security, protection, good life, everything he has here, to go fight a war somewhere far away in very harsh conditions and probably knowing that he will die there? It's not because they're bad people. They honestly think that they're doing the right thing, that they're honoring their nation. They're doing it because they believe that this war will give them a sense of purpose. It will give them a sense of meaning. And it shows where we have got, that people are willing to sacrifice all their choices, all their options, to get a sense of meaning in their life. And today, it is up to you, people like you in this church and outside, to revive the sense of meaning in our world. Because we live in a Western world with so many options. Technology has got us so far, but technology can tell us what can be done. It will never tell us what should be done. It is only our values, it is only our life and our being that will tell us what should be done. And the West should somehow find a way to reconnect to its Judeo-Christian values, to go back to either religion or any, I don't want to take sides, I'm a Christian, I'm a believer, but to go back to the place where you get meaning to your life, when you get a sense of purpose without giving up the options. That religion or faith or organized is not opposite to progress and to innovation and to technology, but it can go hand in hand. Because if we fail in reviving the sense of meaning into our lives, if we keep focusing on our choices and our technologies and forget to ask not just how we can live, but why we live, then we are doomed to failure. And we have to be prepared and take up the challenge that this new world is presenting us, and to face it in a way that will keep our dignity, our humanity, and our ability to be and remain different and respect each other. Thank you for listening to the second part as well.